Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, everybody. It's me, Connor Clancy, host of the Forza Italian Football Podcast. And I'm delighted to say that this week, even though it's an international round of fixtures, we are back with an extra special bonus edition of the podcast. I spoke to Herbie Sykes, author of Juve, 100 Years of an Italian Football Dynasty, about his new book, which was published on the 15th of October this year. It is the definitive history of the iconic football club, the glory, the scandal, the stars, and its enduring influence on Italian life. Really, really interesting conversation with Herbie, if I do say so myself. I encourage you to listen to this, and we are delighted to say that we are offering a giveaway of his fascinating book. So head over to Twitter at Serie A FFC, Instagram and Facebook at Forza Italian Football to find out how you can get yourself a copy of Herbie's book. Anyway, that's enough from me, and over to Herbie to talk about his book and the club that are so divisive in Italian football. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Herbie Sykes on the podcast now to talk about his new book, all about Juventus. It's titled Juve, 100 Years of an Italian Football Dynasty. Herbie, thank you so much for taking your time to come and join me on the podcast.
Pleasure.
I'm going to start with quite a simple question. Why this book? Why Juventus?
Well, it's a long and winding road, this story, but essentially, I've done for 12 years and saw my first Turin derby in 1991. So I've got kind of vested interest in Juve. I'm not a Juve fan. I was a Toro fan initially.
Ah, okay.
But obviously, Juventus, the Agnellis, Fiat, are essentially the story of the Italian century, of the 20th century. My city, my adopted home, is conditioned absolutely, unequivocally by the Agnellis and by Fiat, and obviously by extension Juventus, because the reality of Juventus is that it always was a political and a geopolitical construct. It's just a fascinating subject. They're fascinating. The club is fascinating. And of course it's unique in the sporting context. It's 100 years more or less of the same family, and that doesn't exist anywhere else.
A lot of our listeners won't necessarily be familiar with Italy and the cities within it. Can you explain what you mean by that? That Turin as a city is conditioned by the Agnelli family, by Juve, by everything that surrounds the club?
Yeah, Okay, well, Turin is to Fiat as Detroit was to Ford, in the sense that this at a certain point in time, the population of Turin exceeded 1 million. It's now down to about 900,000 because we're post-industrial now. But Fiat, everybody in Turin worked for Fiat or for somebody that worked for that for, or for the suppliers of Fiat or for the suppliers of the suppliers of Fiat. And Fiat was the motor of the Italian economy. After the war, when Italy took, after World War II, Italy and Greece in particular were at risk of communist contagion. Okay, the Communist Party in Italy was extremely strong, and put to cut a very long story short, Italy took a lot of money, of the Marshall Plan money, from the Americans. Okay, and invested it in the motorization of the country. So the economic plan or the economic boom of Italy post-war, when Italian society, Italian life changed radically, was all predicated upon the manufacture of motor cars and infrastructure, motorways, and so on and so forth. So Fiat became fabulous, and the Agnelli family, and by extension their football club, became fabulously wealthy. Okay, so people drove Fiat cars, they drove them on Fiat motorways, and Fiat steel built the railways and so on and so forth. And Fiat was a massive success story, and it was indivisible from Italy's success story. You have to bear in mind that in the 50s and 60s, Italian GDP was growing at 8% year on year. So just huge amounts of money flooding in, and with them, political influence, and Juventus was, if you like, for the Agnelli family, so for successive Agnelli children. I was talking specifically about Gianni and Umberto Agnelli. It was a toy. It was what they did when they reached adulthood before they moved into one of the serious jobs, which would be Fiat. Yeah, and so that, broadly speaking, is what Fiat always, what Juventus always was and is, in point of fact. It's part of the Agnelli family fortune, yeah, and they lavish vast fortunes on it.
Juve are obviously the most dominant club in Italy now. They're the biggest club here. So how has that become to be true, given that, as you say, they were almost the toy of the family, and now they're this all-conquering force in Italian football?
Yeah, well, they can afford to be, in the first instance, because they're massively rich. They have seemingly unlimited wealth. What's interesting about Juventus is it was built, it was never... engineered. I mean, it's 1923 when they bought the thing. The kind of precept, one of the precepts of Juventus is that it's Italy's team. Okay, so we always refer to the La fidanzata dell'Italia and so on and so forth. As distinct to being a parochial, myopic, one-eyed Torinese construct, which Torino is, obviously, Juve was kind of configured to represent Fiat, and Fiat had a national audience and a national customer base, if you like. And Juventus was instrumental in that. So when in 1934, for example, Italy won the World Cup with six, I think, Juventini starters, yeah, that kind of said, we're bigger than Torino, we're bigger than our city, we're bigger than Piemonte, because the Piemontese are very insular, traditionally or historically very insular. And so Juve always aspired to be Italy's team, as distinct to Turin's team. So whilst Milan and Inter represent, broadly speaking, Milan and Lombardia, yeah, and the Milanese hinterlands, Juve always had much more ecumenical ideas about itself. It wanted to be Italy's team, not categorically not the team of Torino, because that its scope, and obviously it was part of the Agnelli Empire, part of the Fiat Empire.
Well, that is something that you do see thrown at Juve quite often, which is that they're not a Torinese team. They're a team that represent Italy. And we saw the jokes recently when they played at Crotone that it was the derby of Calabria, right?
Of course, yeah. Absolutely. The point is, every game they play is a derby.
Yeah.
And that's why they fill column inches and put bums on seats, because every game they play, by definition, is a derby, because out there in the provinces... you mentioned before, we spoke about Umbria and Abruzzo and Marche, where there are no big population centres. They support Juve.
Yeah.
Half of them support Juve, and so all the games are big games because they're all derbies in effect, in a material sense. Yeah.
Since I've been in Parma, I think I've seen the Tardini sell out or close to sell out twice, both for Juve matches.
Yeah, with Juventini. Yeah,
exactly. The split is about 50-50.
Yeah, and they've been very, very successful in that. I think to understand Italian football, you really need to understand something about the fascist era, because the fascists always, if you like, appropriated sporting success. So when Juve won, or when Italy won the World Cup in 34 and 38, predominantly with Juve players, the regime took that, okay, and utilized it for geopolitical propaganda purposes, okay. So what happened in effect was that Juve became synonymous with the Azzurri and with the national team and with Italian sport, and that still holds true today because they take pains to make that happen.
How is that split in the city of Turin? Because like I say, you get those jokes that Juve aren't Torinese. It's like in England, people say that people in Manchester support Manchester City and everywhere else support United. Is it that black and white?
I would say that Torino is probably amongst the people of my generation and the older generation, people whose parents grew up with the Grande Torino, the great Torino team between 1940 and 49, and out in the Piemontese provinces, so if you think about Cuneo, if you think about maybe Novara, Biella, it's very much Toro, and it's however it's changing very obviously, because it's 10 years now that Juve are winning the league every year, and so in some respects. So whilst Toro is rooted in Piemonte, absolutely, and it's almost, and it is a, and there is a kind of almost a politicization of this. If you're a Toro fan, it probably signifies that you're indigenous Piemontese, for want of a better term, that your parents were Piemontese, your grandparents were Piemontese, you are of here, obviously, I don't know the exact demographic in the city, but there are a great many more Juve fans in Turin now than there would have been probably 25 or 30 years ago, by dint of the fact that football is much more global and Juve is fabulously successful and Toro just isn't. So, in the 50s and 60s, you'd massive inward migration into Turin with Fiat and all the stuff around it, and a lot of people came from the south. Huge amounts of people came from the south. Every day, the so-called Treni di Speranza, the Trains of Hope, would drop hundreds of people off at Porta Nuova, the big station in town, and they came from the south because in Turin there was work, and in the agrarian south there was no work. And those people tended to line up behind Juventus because Juventus was successful. It was Italian as distinct to Torinese or Piemontese. And in supporting Juve as distinct to Toro, they kind of asserted their own regional identity. And what they were effectively saying was, yes, we're in Turin, but we're not of Turin. And that's an important distinction. So, that was a moment of huge change. And
And is that still true to this day, where Juve see themselves as Italian representatives rather than Piemonte?
Yeah. Absolutely, I think so. I mean, it's not difficult to deduce. Toro is Toro is I mean, even the location of the respective grounds, you know, Juve is out there at Venaria on the very close to the motorway, and there's a kind of a metaphor in that probably. Toro is very central. They play in the old Olympic Stadium. Yeah, I think so. I mean, football has changed dramatically. It's a lot more global now, and I think people support teams for different reasons perhaps than they did 20, 30, 50 years ago. But I would say, broadly speaking, it's still just about holds, that Toro is the side of the old Piemontese families. Yeah.
Mm. As loved as Juve are by their supporters, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a club in another European country, another Western European country, really, that is as despised, as envied, as loathed as Juve are. Obviously, there are reasons for that which go beyond them just being successful, right?
Yeah, there are. There are reasons. I mean, it was constructed in fascism. It's always been the club of the right. Certainly in Torino, it's the club of the right. Broadly speaking, of people whose political sympathies are of the right, it's synonymous with a certain degree of Machiavellianism. We all know about Moggi and Allodi and these figures, these kind of figures that have sought to subvert sporting justice. So. But what's interesting about them is that everybody makes a decision about Juve. Nobody's indifferent about Juve. Nobody's ambivalent about Juve. They are kind of Marmite in that respect. Yeah. People make a decision and they compel you to make a decision. And they're good, and that's absolutely as they would want it. So in some respects, the whole black and white kind of thing is a good metaphor for them. People really, really, I mean, everybody, without fail, I mean, they're the only side in Italy without a twinship, without any kind of kinship with another side. And there's a reason for that. They don't want it. They absolutely set themselves up to be entirely other, you know. So the language, the vernacular, the way, everything about them is distinct to other Italian sides.
Is it fair to say that your book is more than just a footballing tribute to Juventus? You do touch on the murkier side of the club's operations as well.
Yeah, I mean, they're indivisible. What I would say about Juventus is this: the players are passing through at any given time. So obviously, yes. The story of Juventus is Del Piero, it's Zoff, it's Boniperti, it's these superstar players, yeah? Platini, etc. But the constant is the Agnellis. And the constant is Italy. And Italy and Italians have never really subscribed to Corinthian ideals about sport in the way that, for example, the British might, loosely speaking. And they understand that sport and politics, that football is far bigger than 11 against 11, and that everything that happens on the pitch is prefigured by and conditioned by the boardroom stuff. Yeah. And so, you know, there's a reason that Juventus are fabulously successful and have been for the thick end of 100 years. They condition the landscape around the football, if you like, and have always set out to do that. Umberto Agnelli was president of the FIGC, age 23. And there's a good reason for that, yeah? And on occasion, the reality is, the fact of the matter is, that they have been seen and been guilty of sporting fraud. I mean, now, what they would say is, well, that everybody does it. We're probably more successful at it than others. And you could argue that's the case, but yeah, I mean, over a number, I mean, if it were just one instance of chicanery, then you'd say, okay, well, Moggi happened, and we move on from there. But over the years, it's been, you know, there is quite a lot of this stuff, which of course explains why Italians are absolutely convinced that they're implicitly and intrinsically corrupt. even, you know. So, yeah.
It is quite strange, though, isn't it, how these unsavoury incidents have repeated themselves consistently throughout the club's history. It's not like a once-off thing. People point to Calciopoli because it's the most recent that they can remember, but there were countless before that.
Yeah, I mean, in the 70s, particularly, Italian football was lousy. I mean, it was the degree of corruption was, it was fairly endemic. And the book talks about, you know, the early 70s and the period of, but you know, Milan were also culpable. You know, they weren't operating in isolation, but Juve employed Allodi, who'd been fabulously successful with Inter, and Allodi was extremely skilled at the stuff, I'm trying to be politic here, the stuff that informs success in Italian football, yeah? And Allodi taught Moggi, and Moggi was extremely successful in his role, yeah? With all that implies. So, yeah, I mean, there is a certain, there's a certain amount of skill involved in engineering success in Italian football, and it's and there always was. So there's the famous instance with Brian Clough when his Derby side played in Turin in 1973-74, can't remember, and the ref booked Gemmell and McFarlane, who were Derby's two best players, and saw to it they were suspended for the second leg. And this just went on and on and on and on. And it was part of the currency of the game for many, many years, yeah? And it doesn't just wash through, of course. So, yeah, it's... and that's one of the reasons that the Italian football is so endlessly fascinating, because there's some pretty murky stuff goes on.
Yeah, since I've been here, it seems to be the case that you meet someone new and they ask who you support, almost expecting you to say Juve. I personally support Atalanta, so when I say that, there's like almost a sigh of relief that it's someone that wasn't Juventus.
Yeah, it's anybody but them.
Exactly.
Anybody but them. So, yeah, I mean, but again, that's part of the construct. They're absolutely good with that. They're not interested in being anybody's second favourite team, because being a second favourite team doesn't put money in the till, doesn't put bums on seats. There's no value in that for them. So, yeah, but absolutely, that's prevalent wherever you go in Italy, of course, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're either for them or against them, and that's as they would want it. Yeah,
for sure. In terms of Juve now, they've obviously made moves in the last few years. I'm thinking immediately of the changing of the crest to become what is, I think, what they call the lifestyle brand rather than a football team. So how would you define Juventus in their current existence?
I would define them... I have something of a problem with modern football, because it's obviously a money machine. I suppose it was ever thus to some degree, and we shouldn't delude ourselves that it wasn't, because certainly thinking back 30 years when I started following Italian football, it was already essentially you'd got extremely wealthy owners lavishing money. Parma would be a case in point with Tanzi. They didn't always have on their football teams. The crest with the two J's and the Juve and more, and the more being the kind of the collateral stuff they do to generate revenues for the football club. It's just a reality, and they're extremely good at it. Now, you could say that it's not sport, but sport takes place, and the football itself is never not beautiful. That's the reason that we love it. There's stuff around it that they do to generate revenues, and they're very skilled at it. And the Agnellis are insanely rich. So, you know, if needs be, I think back to when they bought John Charles in 57 and they bought Sivori in 57 and Nicolet. So they've been doing this for many, many, many years, right from the get-go. They've, you know, for 100 years, it was Juventus that transformed football into a marketplace. And for 100 years, they've just been outspending people, you know. Berlusconi came along and turned that on its head for a while, but fundamentally, they outlast everybody because they're very, very well.
Yeah, the others will come and go, but Juve are that one constant.
Yeah, because Juve are the Agnellis. You know, that's who they are. It's what they are, and they're extremely powerful people. And it's difficult actually to articulate that. Because you living in Turin, you kind of absorb it. So everything that this town is, yeah, and then you could say the same in Melfi and other places, other parts of Italy. Everything this town is prefigured by Fiat. So whilst they don't necessarily manufacture a lot, at a certain point in time, they're employing 90,000 people at Lingotto and Minafior, the other two big plants. They can throw money at it.
Yeah. Over the course of writing this book, I mean, you've obviously dug deep. There will have probably been some notable highs and lows throughout the history of Juventus that were maybe more attention grabbing than the others. Are there any obvious high points and low points in the club's history that spring to mind?
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
I suppose Heysel is kind of indelible. I think with Juve, you, because it's indivisible from the national team, because there was always traditionally there was always a Blocco Juventino in the Azzurri, yeah? So Spain 82, Tardelli's goal, yeah, and everything around that moment in time is very interesting. So notwithstanding the fact that they weren't wearing a black and white shirt, you know, six of them were Azzurri, and that Azzurri team, that the 1982 World Cup is synonymous. 96 when they beat Ajax to win the Champions League finally, notwithstanding the fact that there's some, you know, there are some doping issues around that. I think the side of Boniperti, Charles and Sivori in the early 60s was sensational, and so on and so forth. The Platini years, Platini was a genius footballer. and as a metaphor for Juventus, he's perfect. Yeah. And the theme in the 30s when they won five Serie A titles on the spin. So yeah, throughout it's a constant, you know, Connor. There, the others may come and go. And we saw it with Atalanta having a great moment, relatively speaking. Now, Parma in the 90s, and so on and so forth. But Juve is fabulously successful. In fact, they're so successful now. I think we're having this discussion the other day about them having won 9 championships on the spin, 10 championships on the spin, in effect. Is that it actually devalues the brand of Italian football, yeah, because there's no serious competition. And that's problematical. So until such time as Inter or Milan or somebody can get close, it all feels a little bit mechanical. You know, it feels a bit utilitarian, like you just know what's going to happen. And that ultimately is probably not good for the brand, conversely, paradoxically.
Yeah, well, they had won, 7 in a row, and then they signed Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah,
kind of course, like, okay, yeah, right. So this is just going to continue then, you know?
Yeah, this is going to. I mean, obviously the object, but the object of the exercise there, I think, was to try and win the Champions League. Mm. But also, he's the big marquee statement signing, isn't he? That they need to make periodically.
Yeah,
he's a way to say, okay, we are actually competing with the cities and with the PSGs of this world.
That is something that I personally feel quite strongly about with Juve, is that they've signed Cristiano Ronaldo not to continue winning the Scudetto. He was signed for Europe and they haven't won it. How hard is that for them to swallow, that they still haven't been able to conquer Europe?
They see it as a curse, and it is kind of a curse. If you look at it historically, yeah, something always goes wrong. Mm. Yeah, they, I mean, they're further away. I'm not entirely, for me, it's counterproductive, because, of course, what happens is the team becomes him and 10 domestiques, yeah, 10 water carriers. And so I'm not actually sure that the side is particularly functional at this stage. I think everything hinges around him. And there's something that doesn't. Quite, I think they're a million miles away from it at this point. They weren't so very far from it before they signed him. Yeah, that's the promised land, because Serie A is kind of a given, in the same way that, Celtic are always going to win in Scotland, or Ajax in Holland, and so on and so forth. It's a monopoly really here. But they don't seem to be. They seem to me to be a very long way from it.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that may be conditioned by the fact that Serie A is relatively poor by comparison to La Liga, for example, and the Premiership. The quality of the opposition they're playing week in and week out is not actually that great, and so it's quite there's an abyss between playing the better Italian sides and the better European sides. So that may have a bearing on it. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, trips to Crotone aren't exactly helpful for preparing. Yeah. But anyway, on to you. You came over to that Turin derby in 1991. You were, 23, 24? What prompted your decision to come to Turin? Why that?
I was a big City fan. I was a big Man City fan, and a group of us were Man City fans. And I'd read an article about Toro, actually, in a fanzine. And I was intrigued. And back in the day, in the early 90s, England had a kind of a big five. And the big five in England then would have been Spurs, Arsenal, Everton, Liverpool, and United. That was as was. I mean, obviously, the landscape has changed dramatically since then. But they were the big five. And it's in Italy at that five. So you two clubs in the south and three in the northwest. And in Italy, you'd the two Roman clubs, you'd Milan, Inter, and Juve, and they were the big five. And so, again, geographically, three big clubs in the north, and two in the south, and then you'd Toro and City. So in some, and we were similarly crap, essentially. And so we were intrigued by that. I was intrigued by that. And I'd read something about the Grande Torino and Superga and that stuff. And but in a nutshell, we were season ticket holders at City, and we went everywhere, and we got knocked out of the FA Cup, so we had a free weekend, and that weekend coincided with the Turin Derby. And I had some friends, some Italian friends, who organised some tickets. So we took a train from Lincoln to Turin. It was too expensive to fly back then. So we got on a train and arrived in Turin and went to the derby. And I loved it. I loved the place. I loved the football. Because English football back then was pretty dire, relatively speaking. It was technically, it was poor. It was blood and snot, but not a great deal of art. And this was magical, you know, this was romance and colour and Italy had the best players in the world back then. So we came to the derby, loved it, sensational. And then I was the self-elected president of this little club that we had, and we came every year. And then subsequently met my wife here whilst working on a book about cycling and so on and so forth. So, yeah.
A fantastic little trip, man, to take the train to Turin.
Yeah, well, it was a big trip. I mean, it was a big thing. Traveling back then was much. It was quite quixotic, you know. Mm. And it was a long way in every sense.
Yeah.
So we changed at King's Cross or wherever. We couldn't afford to fly, Connor. It was too expensive to fly. It was like 500 quid.
Right.
And so, but we could afford to take the train just about. So we cobbled the money together, took the train. And it was odd because I'll try and be concise, but we couldn't speak Italian, none of us.
Yeah.
So we got off the train at Porta Nuova, which is the big train station in the centre of town, and all we knew that was that there were four tickets waiting for us at the souvenir shop. Okay, so we automatically assumed, because we're English, that the souvenir shop would be at the ground, because that's the way it was in English football.
Yeah.
We had no idea where the ground was, really. We had a map. So we walked from the centre of Turin to Venaria, which is where the old ground, the Delle Alpi, and which has been remodelled as Juve's new ground. So we walked there, and it's about kind of 10 kilometres, assuming that's where we'd pick our tickets. So we didn't have a word of Italian between us. We got there, and the only person there was a security guard who put us back in a taxi, which took us straight back to where we'd started. Because the souvenir shop was in the middle of town.
Yeah.
And that was it, really. And then, of course, there are lots of journalists. They've got three sports, daily sports papers with pages to fill. And they were interested that we would have come from Lincoln to watch the derby. And so it became a bit of a course celebre, you know, in the way that it does. And so that was the beginnings of it, if you like.
Yeah. Does sound amazing, and it still, there are elements of that old Italy which are still true today. That chaos and predictability, the entering into the land of the unknown, you know.
Yeah. Italy's very provincial, and Italians are very provincial, and you'll know that living in Parma.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that defines it, and one of the things that's beautiful about this country is it's also one of its great weaknesses is. It's very easy to fall in love with Italy, Connor, as you know.
Yeah, and
it's not as easy to live in Italy.
But
what's not to love about this place? For all its problems, all its shortcomings, all its clumsiness, you can't not love it.
Yeah, living here is as difficult as visiting is beautiful, you know. It's not an easy thing. Herbie, thank you very much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you about your book.
Lovely, Connor. Thanks for having me, and all the best. Take care.
Thank you very much. Campionato di calcio italiano.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.